There's absolutely a ton happening right now, in large part, like you said, because of Egypt, because of all of the funding that's moving. Ultimately, what we have now is this massive legislation that the administration that actually has the responsibility for implementing it didn't have a whole lot of time to figure out and ask questions about, like, what does this mean? How are we going to do this? I don't think any single person probably thinks that this is being implemented perfectly, but that probably means that the administration is doing something right.
This is Infrastructure Junkies.
Welcome, Infrastructure Junkies, to your show. This is a podcast created by right-of-way professionals for right-of-way professionals. The Infrastructure Junkies podcast is the voice of the right-of-way industry, exploring eminent domain, right-of-way acquisition, and infrastructure development. The Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act, where are we now? We're about to find out. I'm Dave Arnold.
And I'm Kristen Short.
We've done two episodes on EJA, or what's also known as Build Back Better. In our second installment, attorney Philip Sanchez foretold the tsunami that was headed towards our industry. We're all really busy right now.
Boy, are we. And I'm hoping that what we're going to learn today is that we're at the very beginning of EJA and not the tail end of it.
That would be nice. Yes. Kristen had the bright idea to bring an expert onto the show to give us an update. Where are we? Where are we headed? How's it going? And most importantly, how much longer is this going to last? Kristen, who do we have today?
Well, I am so excited to introduce to our listeners, Shant Boyajian. Shant is a partner in Nossaman's Washington, D.C. office. Shant advises public agencies on a wide range of innovative methods to procure and deliver the nation's largest, most complex infrastructure projects. He is also one of the nation's leading experts in the policy issues behind infrastructure strategy, having previously served as senior counsel to the U.S. Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. Prior to Shant's position in the Senate, he served as counsel to the Subcommittee on Highways and Transit for the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. Earlier in his career, he served as a law clerk to the General Counsel's office at the U.S. Department of Energy and as legislative aide to the vice chairman of the Loudoun County Board of Supervisors in Loudoun County, Virginia.
As Kristen mentioned, Shant is from the Nossaman LLP firm, which, as all you listeners know, is deeply, deeply involved in our industry, and that's a law firm full of thought leaders within the right-of-way class. If you get a chance, go to his biography on the Nossaman website. This guy's legit. Shant, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for making time. And I understand you've hosted a podcast before. Your firm has a podcast called Digging in the Dirt. Is that right?
That's true. That's true. And I have had the privilege of participating in a number of our firm's podcasts. And it's a pleasure to be on yours. I don't know. They let me out of the cage or something.
Yeah, shouldn't you be billing hours or something? You work for one of those big DC firms, right?
I was doing that before this, and I'll probably be doing that after this.
Okay.
Well, we're glad they let you out of the cage, because I have been dying to know more about, you know, these are the best episodes. I love it when there's something that I need to know the answers to these questions.
Right, right.
I think everybody does. I think that we're seeing in real time, in real life, the impacts of EJA on people in our industry. I have questions. I'm assuming our listeners probably have questions, and it sounds like you're the guy to answer our questions.
Yeah, Shant, as a fellow attorney, my phone's been ringing off the hook for projects which are fully funded. And normally, you know, you hear about things and they got to wait on funding, and clients are calling up and saying, we're fully funded, ready to go. We're going to start making offers, and we want to have counsel on board. And we're getting it from all sides right now. So what's going on? tell us a little bit about how EJA is making my phone ring. What's the magic here?
No, I mean, that's a great question. There's absolutely a ton happening right now, in large part, like you said, because of EJA, because of all of the funding that's moving. I do probably need to put a little bit of a damper on some of the enthusiasm over the funding levels.
Oh.
And we can talk a bit more about that in a minute. But there's a couple things going on under EJA, so many new programs. And, you know, there are a lot of really interesting things about this landmark legislation. I mean, it truly is a landmark bill. People have described it as a once in a generation or once in a lifetime infrastructure law. And it truly is that. You know, before I joined Nossaman, I had the privilege of having some really unique experiences on Capitol Hill. And at the time, I worked on the largest infrastructure bill in history, which was roughly 25% of the size of Egypt. And so that just puts it into perspective, kind of the actual magnitude of what we're talking about here. But part of the issue is that EJIA covers so many additional classes of infrastructure beyond what the federal government has typically viewed and typically acted upon in a transportation reauthorization bill. And so in addition to just highways, transit, rail, now you also have airports, broadband, clean water, inland waterways, inland ports, many, many, many other types of infrastructure classes being funded under this bill. And so at the end of the day, even though we're talking about a $1.2 trillion bill, we're actually only talking about roughly a 50% increase in funding levels above what had previously been spent on kind of the core infrastructure classes like highways and transit. So while, yes, it is a remarkable infrastructure investment and a landmark piece of legislation, it's not like a 4 or 5x times type of spending on highways, bridges, rail, that type of thing. It's really talking about 50% increase.
So let me see if I can bounce an example off of you. When I was headed to the airport a couple days ago, headed to Texas, as a matter of fact, I'm going from the area where we park in the baggage claim and drop off. This is in Norfolk International Airport to where the main terminals are. And it's a long walk. And there used to be one of those conveyor belts that carry humans on there. You know what I'm talking about? Back in the day. Yeah.
A moving sidewalk.
A moving, is that what it's called? I call it a conveyor belt that moves humans.
Okay.
And they took it out about 2 years ago. And now there's this big, beautiful sign saying, coming soon, a new human conveyor belt sidewalk, courtesy of the Infrastructure Act. So is that what you're talking about, as that's infrastructure funding that's really not going to our industry?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's airport eligibility for certain parts of that funding. Historically, airport terminals are funded under a different federal program.
Right.
And so if you're lumping some of that into that $1.2 trillion figure, it just starts to whittle away at the actual amount of increase for the core types of infrastructure that you typically talk about when you're talking about like a big infrastructure bill.
Right.
Obviously, the federal government also funds airports and airport facilities. And so you need to be specific in understanding what you're actually talking about when you talk about the funding.
And maybe I'm talking about the wrong thing and I've got it incorrect, but...
Well, Sean has already deflated my balloon of enthusiasm.
Oh, no.
I've got one more thing to say that's probably less enthusiastic and then...
Oh, no.
Wait, let me cue the sad trombone just in case we need it. Okay, go ahead.
I wanted to get the bad news out of the way early. You know, obviously COVID was a really crazy time for every industry. I mean, everybody kind of reorganized their life around this. But part of the issue when you have a constrained workforce, when you have these supply chain challenges, is it makes it a lot more expensive to do your projects. And I'm sure this is not a new concept on your podcast. Any infrastructure junkie can tell you that it's going to be a lot of expense sourcing your materials, all the different things that you need to get these projects done. In a recent study by one of the transportation think tanks here in DC called the ENO Center for Transportation, roughly about 10 months ago, I think they came out with this. They did a study of the construction cost index on highway spending and actually found that the buying power of the Federal Highway Administration's spending was actually lower now than it was pre-EJIA, because the construction cost escalators are so much higher than they were before.
The dollars don't go as far.
That's right.
Sad trombone, for sure. When we first started talking about EJIA, and especially learning about it through those first two episodes that we did about what it is and where we're headed, I thought, well, this is just a massive inpouring of funding into the kind of work that we do.
Yeah.
And hearing it from your perspective, and that it's much, much, much broader than railways and highways and transportation, I would say that I could have a deflated feeling about this, except that I am seeing an increase in the work that's available to people in our industry right now. So maybe that's okay, that it's not quite as much right. of an increase as we thought. I'm always glass half full.
So that's the bad news. But here's the good news. The good news is that EJIA did two things primarily. I mean, it did a lot of things, but we're going to talk about two things. The first thing it did is it provided 5 years of funding certainty for project sponsors, which is critical for them to actually plan for their larger projects to actually figure out what they want to do and know that they have the funding certainty to do that. The second thing it did is it shifted a significant number of federal programs so that a lot of the funding now, obviously, it's still the majority is still going out under the traditional formula programs that go to each state DOT on the highway side, each large transit provider, public transportation provider on the transit side. But there are many new discretionary programs now. These programs that are not allocated automatically by formula, but which are controlled by U.S. Department of Transportation or other federal agencies, and applicants apply for those funds, kind of make the best case for their projects. And as a result of that, it actually allows sort of larger slugs of money to go out and really kickstart these big projects that would have difficulty being funded under a more traditional formula-only type approach. And so a lot of the activity that we're seeing is these projects that have been in the planning documents for decades, but now there's finally an opportunity for project sponsors to actually pursue funds in addition to what they're kind of automatically receiving under the formula programs to be able to actually do their large projects.
Okay. So these programs that you're talking about to be able to go after that funding, is that under the umbrella of the EJA 1.2 trillion?
That's right. Yeah. There were tremendous number of new discretionary programs that were created under EJA that allowed many more opportunities for project sponsors to go after funds for their projects and to go after funds for a lot of different types of projects than they previously were able to do so.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, that brings me to another question, which is, we're talking about, is it 1.2 trillion? Was that how much EJA was originally? How much of that has been spent so far? Where are we in the dollars?
That's a great question. So I don't have an actual exact dollar amount for you, but a few months ago, the Biden-Harris administration did put out sort of we're 2 years in, here's an update. And they announced that over $400 billion of that 1.2 have already gone out the door, have been allocated and sent out, and it's supported over 40,000 projects across the country. And so, you know, that's roughly a third. We're 2 years into a five-year bill. That number is obviously a little bit higher now since that number is a few months old. But that's also not unexpected that you'd maybe be a tiny bit behind from a sort of progress basis because it takes so long to actually stand up these new programs, get the money flowing. And the federal government has absolutely been getting the money flowing over the last year and a half in particular. I mean, it's almost like on a weekly basis that new funding announcements are rolling out. I've never seen some of our public agency clients as busy as they have been over the last 18 months tracking this information. And so it's really been an exciting time for the infrastructure industry, as you noted at the top.
Of course. Well, so you're talking about the funding's rolling as expected. Has the program in general, has everything kind of rolled out as anticipated? Have there been surprises or bumps and bruises, or has this just been, yep, here was the plan and off we went?
You know, that's a great question. There's no simple answer to that. There are a lot of people that probably would have liked to see different programs implemented differently. There are a lot of people that have really appreciated the way that some of these programs have been rolling out. And this goes to the way that this legislation came together, but it was really based in part on the political climate at the time, but a very unconventional process to get to an enacted EJA. The typical sort of process, if there is one, is the House of Representatives will pass their version of the bill and they'll go through the committee process and everything like that. The Senate will do the same. They'll kind of appoint conferees and get together and figure out what the differences are and what the final package should look like. And then each chamber passes it again. The president signs it and everybody has a big party. This was not that at all. And so there are pros and cons to that. But ultimately, what we have now is this massive legislation that the administration that actually has the responsibility for implementing it didn't have a whole lot of time to figure out and ask questions about, like, what does this mean? How are we going to do this? What are you actually expecting when you talk, when you say XYZ? And so a lot of the questions, a lot of the so-called bumps in the road have resulted from the administration just trying to figure out and do the best that they can with the language that they've been given in this bill. And that takes an enormous amount of effort to kind of go through that process of putting together these notices of funding opportunity, all of the associated regulations and guidance. And so I don't think any single person probably thinks that this is being implemented perfectly, but that probably means that the administration is doing something right.
Well, has there been any feedback from agencies, condemning authorities, what have you, who are seeking this funding about not feeling like they had the right information, or it was complicated, or the process was, has that gone smoothly? Has there been any feedback on getting access to the funding if you're one of those agencies?
Yeah, there has. And there are two answers to that question. The first is the law is the law. And if the law is drafted in a way that is convoluted or complicated or process heavy, then that is the way that the agencies are required under that law to implement it. And so there may be programs that are just complicated to navigate. And that's the nature of those programs. And maybe that was intentional, maybe it wasn't, but that's just the way that it is right now. The other issue, though, which I think is the greater cause of consternation, I should say, for some applicants, is the fact that these discretionary grant programs are tremendously oversubscribed. And what I mean by that is you may have applications for 10 or 100 times the value that's actually available to be obligated under that funding opportunity. And so USDOT, for example, might be reviewing thousands of applications for a funding program, knowing that they're only actually going to be able to award about 1% of those.
Oh, wow.
And the way that the process works is experts throughout USDOT will review these applications against the statutory criteria and the criteria that they put in their notice of funding opportunity. And they'll either eliminate the ones that are non-responsive or give a medium recommended, highly recommended rating. And then once the highly recommended and the recommended tranches, they basically get elevated to political decision makers, you know, the political appointees that run the department. And at that point, there's much less visibility, I should say, into how those selections are made. And I think that's where a lot of project sponsors, a lot of applicants for this funding start to get frustrated, because they may have a recommended or a highly recommended application year after year, and know that they're getting to the secretary's desk, but never actually getting an award.
Well, what you just said, of course, you're way, way, way too diplomatic to say this, but what you just said is the frustration may be due to backroom pork deals, pork barrel deals.
That's probably one way to put it, actually.
And maybe not selected completely on the merits. There could be some backroom horse trading going on.
I don't know that that's how I would characterize it.
Good, good. I'm glad you wouldn't.
Me too.
I mean, ultimately, the fact of the matter is, if you've got more demand than you have supply.
Is your office burning down, by the way?
No, I'm sorry. I'm on the corner of New York Avenue and 14th Street, and yeah. I think we've had like four fire trucks in the last 10 minutes.
That's what happens when you're a big-time lawyer. You're in the heart of it. Okay, sorry, Sean. Go ahead.
No, please. I apologize. So I wouldn't necessarily characterize it as horse trading as much as the fact that you've got more interest in a particular program than you have funding available to allocate. And so there has to be a point at which there are some trade-offs that are being made to make those selections. In these programs, oftentimes there are what's called quote-unquote additional criteria or additional considerations. And that recognizes the fact that you are going to be in the situation where you are going to have a lot of interest in a particular funding program, and you're not going to be able to just give everybody what they want for those projects that kind of warrant it and make its way through the more objective criteria. And so there are things like geographical distribution, looking at the different sizes of the applicants. If it's for a metropolitan planning organization, for example, you know, small ones have to get a certain share, larger ones have to get a certain share of these planning funds. And that's the type of trade-offs that need to be made. And that's the type of decisions that we vest in our governmental leaders. And that's why they're appointed, you know, and confirmed by the Senate to implement those programs.
This episode of Infrastructure Junkies is generously sponsored by Blackbird Right-of-Way. If you are looking for compliant, timely, and innovative relocation solutions, this is exactly what Blackbird does. Kristen Short and her team deliver every parcel, every time. Find them at blackbirdrow.com, blackbirdrow.com. So the first time we talked about this was with an attorney from Ohio by the name of Jeremy Young. The focus of our discussion was what I would call the spending spectrum. How much of a percentage or how many dollars were going to this industry, highways, rails, fiber optics.
Electric cars.
charging stations, things like that. But it seemed that they had apportioned it among the various industries, for lack of a better description. Has the money been pushed out as envisioned, at least proportionately, or has it been switched up in their backroom deals? I'm sorry, I couldn't help myself.
No. I understand exactly what you're asking. This is anecdotal, so I don't have a definitive answer to that. But from what I've seen, most of the money has been pushed out with relative ease by the Department of Transportation. I mean, there's been a lot of work that's gone into it, but they are already well equipped to stand up funding programs and dispense with funding, because that's a lot of what they have been doing historically. Not every mode of transportation may have had that experience, you know, Amtrak and the new rail funding, for example. I mean, FRA, the Federal Railroad Administration, historically a regulating agency, now they have an incredible amount of funding to obligate. So they have gone through some growing pains. But a lot of the other agencies, EPA, the Department of Energy, for example, I mean, they may have had smaller funding programs. They've divvied up, but now they've got billions and billions and billions of dollars, new programs to stand up. I think things have gone a little bit slower there. At least it seemed to me like they've been a little bit more cautious, so to speak. They've done a lot more outreach around what these programs should look like than you might have expected. And as a result, the funding has actually, in some instances, hasn't actually started to flow yet. But once they turn that tap on, I mean, it's going
to
be heavy.
Yeah, I think this is a good time to drill down on a topic that I think you know quite a bit about. You certainly know more than I do about it. When we discussed this at the outset, there appeared to me to be just ungodly amounts of money earmarked for the electric vehicle industry, charger stations. I don't know whether it was for right-of-way acquisition or what, but just seemed to me to be an awful lot of money to gamble on what many of us still consider to be an unproven commodity. You know, are electric vehicles here to stay? Are they really a good idea? Do they really save us on emissions in the long run? Those are debates for another day, but there was a big gamble placed on that industry. And has that gone as planned? Or, you know, I sometimes see these indicators that we're leaning away from the electric vehicle industry now. And I don't know. I don't know, Sean. You would certainly know more than I would.
David, that's an excellent question. There's a really remarkable development in EJA, and you really started to get to it. And that is a lot of the funding around EV charging infrastructure. I mean, across EJA, across the Inflation Reduction Act, there's a lot of different incentives kind of baked in for the EV vehicle adoption in general, but specifically in EJA, there's a new Federal Highway Administration formula program, the NEVI program, which has a very narrow set of eligibilities. So this is really kind of nerdy, but it's incredibly important because typically there have been five kind of core federal highway formula programs. They've all had relatively broad applicability. One was focused on the largest facilities. One was focused on other types of facilities, safety-related activities. Now you have a formula program focused only on EV charging infrastructure. That's the only thing you can spend this money on. And that's the first part. The second part is it's a formula program. So every single state is now getting this money every single year. And the reason it was structured like that is because a lot of policymakers view the primary impediment to EV adoption as the range anxiety that people experience. You know, what is going to happen to me if I run out of my battery? And so I had the privilege of working on sort of the predecessor section in the US code in the 2015 bill to this program. And what we did was we realized we weren't going to be able to create a brand new formula funding program. We did make these activities eligible under a different program. But what we did is we required states to work with the US Department of Transportation to actually figure out where you want these sort of alternative fueling and EV charging corridors. And so states over the last 5-6 years have gone through that process of figuring out, okay, what makes the most sense for our state? What are these corridors going to be? So there's a whole map. If you go on the U.S. Department of Transportation's website, you'll be able to see where these corridors are. And now this funding is going to those corridors. These chargers have to be within a mile of every exit. Every 50 miles, there has to be a charger. And so this funding has to go to build out that nationwide network. Now, here's the third wrinkle. And this gets into a much broader discussion that will probably bore the socks off of your listeners. But our federal policy when it comes to transportation hasn't really had any connection to use for decades. And what I mean by that is the actual allocation of the formula funding is no longer based on any actual like mileage, bridge condition, any activities, any real performance measures that's going on in a particular state. It's now just a proportion baked in after, at the last year of safety, Lou, which was the 2005 bill. When that bill expired, whatever percentage of the formula program your state got, that's what you get. And that's essentially how it stayed. And so what you have now is you've got an EV infrastructure formula program that is going out based on the proportion that you get of the overall program. And so what happens is, as a result, you've got some densely populated states that may get a fairly high percentage of the funding. They'll be able to probably build out most of their network with this tranche of funding under EJA. And then you've got states like Montana that get an incredibly small percentage of the overall federal funding under the federal formula programs, have an inordinate amount of mileage that they have to start building this infrastructure. And I think that's where some of the disconnect occurs. This funding program really is going to help cut down on the range anxiety issue. It's going to help actually deploy EV charging in a way that is unprecedented. I mean, there's billions and billions of dollars going out now specifically for this purpose. And I know one of your prior guests really talked about the impact of that and some of the corollaries with the advent of the gasoline automobile and kind of what those filling stations were like and kind of the rapidity with which those developed. But I think the policy problem here is that this is not going to be a sufficient solution to fund an actual nationwide network, at least not under EJA. This is going to have to persist decades and decades into the future and is going to have to be supplemented by a lot of private investment to actually build out a true nationwide network.
Yes, and maybe you can answer a question that nobody has been able to answer to date, and it's this.
I doubt it, but I'll try.
How, Sean, do you deploy an EV charging network when you don't have universal chargers? That's like saying we're going to build a bunch of gas stations, but all the nozzles are different sizes, so you may or may not be able to use it depending on what kind of car you drive.
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is an issue where federal regulation is kind of behind the ball, I would say, and catching up to industry. And they're doing an admirable job trying. But you've got essentially two different standards. You've got the CCS standard, and then you've got the NACS or Tesla standard. It turns out that the vast majority of EVs right now are in that latter category, right? I mean, think what you will about Tesla, about Elon Musk, but those EVs have been deployed on a consumer basis with great success. And part of that, I think, has also been because they haven't focused just on the vehicles, but on the charging network. And so they've got their own standard. That is now in the process. The technology is not ripe yet, but it's in the process of actually being updated to what is called a J3400 standard. And that's basically the NACS connector, but manufacturer agnostic. And that's the direction that I think the market is ultimately going to go into. Federal Highway Administration is watching this extremely closely, but until the actual technology is available for deployment, it's not going to be a hard requirement that these charging infrastructure facilities that are being funded by federal dollars actually have this because the technology doesn't actually exist yet. That said, what we have seen is that the actual project sponsors that are doing these projects, receiving the federal funds, soliciting for these EV charging infrastructure projects, they're not stupid, right? And they know that there is a big disconnect in the market between different charging standards. And so what we have seen is that a lot of them are anticipating not getting away from CCS entirely, not necessarily, but at least facilitating both different standards, both technologies. And so that's obviously something that the federal government is permitting. They're allowing project sponsors to be able to do that. They're not saying you have to use only one of these two standards. And so I think what we've seen is that obviously there is development that needs to happen in the technology across the board, not just in with respect to charging connectors. But I think that project sponsors are going to wind up using both, requiring both once the technology is mature enough to be able to be deployed.
Well, I think he answered the question you've been asking for quite some time.
Pretty darn good. Pretty darn good. So perfect segue into one of my favorite topics and yours too, which is Bruce Springsteen.
That's right.
Actually, it's no segue at all, but we want to talk about the boss because in prepping for this, we understood that you were planning to take your family to their first Springsteen concert. And when I looked you up on your bio, I was a huge Springsteen fan growing up as a teenager. And I realized you're quite a bit younger than me. And I have heard people from your generation say this, and I quote, "Springsteen sucks."
Nobody says that.
Yes. That should be an immediate bar to receiving any funding under Egypt.
Yeah.
If you think the boss sucks, you're out. You don't get any money. I like that.
That's
I
just
like
a checkbox at the bottom.
Right.
Does Bruce Springsteen suck? Yes or no? And then that's it.
So are you really a fan?
I love the boss. Absolutely.
And then do tell, what is your connection with the boss? How'd you get into him since you're such a youngster?
So I appreciate that. Some, including my children, may tend to disagree with you, but I actually have a great story about this, and so does my wife. So she and I have seen The Boss. It was one of our last concerts that we were able to go to before COVID. I know The Boss is an infrastructure junkie, so he's probably listening to this.
Hey, Bruce.
Hey, Bruce. I'll text you later, okay, and see what you think of this guy.
If he would stop canceling his concerts in DC, then I would have been able to take my two children, my two boys, to see him years ago, but as it currently stands, we're scheduled to see him later this summer, and I'm pumped. But no, I grew up in New Jersey, outside of Philadelphia.
There you go.
I have many, many, many fond memories. Actually, most of my childhood memories have Bruce Springsteen as the soundtrack. And my wife, one of her fondest memories is listening to Bruce Springsteen with her mom as they did things around the house. And so she and I both bring a tremendous love and appreciation personally and musically for the boss. I don't know what's not to love. I mean, frankly, he's a poet. I mean, I can't quote what Jon Stewart said about him at his Kennedy Center induction.
Yeah.
Not appropriate, but you know, he's a poet. He's a stalwart of American music scene.
And anyone who thinks he's not a poet has never listened to Thunder Road or sang along. So you could not be more right. But that begs a question here. If Springsteen is the soundtrack to your life, oh my gosh, that makes me want to ask, like, which album? Was it Born in the USA when you were coming home from Vietnam? Or was it Nebraska when you were going through your dark period?
Look, Nebraska, I think, is maybe one of the best records of all time. And I think the story behind it is even better. You know, I know that's not what people typically think of when they think of Bruce Springsteen, but I think that album, front to back, I've listened to it hundreds of times. Every single one will make you cry if you actually listen to it.
Yes. Yes.
So true.
Yeah. Open All Night, one of my favorite songs. Atlantic City,
one of my favorite songs.
And the other thing about The Boss, and then we'll move along, is his albums are frequently a much closer reflection of his life than you think. Now, if you've read his book, what is that? Is his book called Born to Run? If you've read it, you realize his songs are actually made up. He didn't live many of the stories that he tells, except for the one about his sister. Okay, I got the one about Mary, the river, and the album Tunnel of Love, when he was going through a separation and divorce from Julianne Phillips, and he separated from the E Street Band and went home and recorded that on a 4-track recorder, and it's a fantastic album in and of itself. But did you read his book?
I do, yep. Got it on my shelf.
And what did you think? What did you think of The Boss after you read the book?
So to me, it was interesting because I learned a lot more about his childhood and his relationship with his mother than I knew just kind of listening to the music, right? I mean, you know that a lot of this stuff is made up. He's incredibly gifted storyteller. But it was really powerful to hear that and to kind of understand that a little bit more deeply about him. And then to go back and listen to the music, and you can hear snippets of it here and there. I mean, obviously he draws on personal experience in his storytelling.
Well, we saw him about a year ago and he was down a few band members because of COVID, but he played for as three and a half hours.
I couldn't believe it.
It was incredible. It was incredible. So I hope you and your family get to go later this summer, and I hope you have a great time.
That. I hope so too.
Well, let's jump back into some Aegis stuff. Thank you for letting us take that little dog leg about Bruce Springsteen for just a minute. So you mentioned that we are give or take 2 years into this, about a third of the way through the funding. I know that a lot of our listeners are professionals in the right-of-way industry, and we are, like I said, we're seeing the effects of this. Everybody's really busy. Is this funding going to last the full 5 years? How much longer will this last? And then the other question I really want to know the answer to, are we just going to wake up one day and it's like, well, that's over.
Yeah.
Pickings are slim if you're working
Find
in this industry.
Job.
Good
Find
luck.
A new job.
Yeah, those are great questions and they're not the shortest answer. So bear with me and remind me if I get off track here. But I think we are going to see this funding be rolled out over a long period of time. One of the interesting things, one of maybe the most interesting thing about EJA, not only was it non-traditional in the way that it actually was kind of negotiated and ultimately enacted, but it was incredibly unique in that it included both an authorization of the federal transportation programs, as well as a large direct appropriation of funding. And the reason that's unique is because on the Hill, those are very rarely combined into one piece of legislation. Usually you're only talking about programs and you may authorize funding levels under an authorization type of legislation, or you're actually appropriating the funds to pay for those programs, but you rarely do both. This was unique in that it provided not only a long-term authorization of these transportation and infrastructure programs, but it also provided $550 billion immediately for those programs. As much as your listeners are junkies when it comes to infrastructure, I don't want to get into nuances of federal budgetary authority and the different types and all that it means, because that's not super important. The important thing is, because EJA included an authorization in addition to the direct funding, it actually set the funding levels for all of the fiscal years through 2026 for these programs. Mm-hmm. And so now what we expect to see is that Congress will actually appropriate those funds. That's typically how this happens. And based on the type of budgetary authority that we don't need to get into, essentially that money doesn't score for congressional budget purposes. So it doesn't quote unquote cost the government anything because they've already essentially paid for it or borrowed it, as the case may be. It doesn't actually need to get offset if the federal government wants to actually authorize this funding. So basically look at it this way. EJA basically wrote the check for these programs for the next 5 years or through 2026. All Congress has to do is sign it. The money's already been set aside. And so I think for the next 3 years that we have left of EJA, the money will continue to flow. I don't think there's a huge risk that that is going to get clawed back or anything. Then we get to what happens when 2026 is here. And Congress is already thinking about what is going to happen. They're not going to do anything this year because everybody's waiting on what's going to happen in November. And they want to see which parties are a majority in the House and the Senate and who is in the White House. But they are absolutely thinking about this issue. And the two key questions that they're thinking about right now is, what is infrastructure and what is the baseline? What I mean is, when they say, what is infrastructure? We talked about how EJA covers so many different classes of infrastructure in addition to highways, bridges, tunnels, transit, rail, the more traditional classes of infrastructure that the federal government funds under a transportation authorization bill. It covers so many other things. So a big kind of gating question is going to be, like, how broad are we going to go? Are we going to try to cover everything that EJA covered, or are we just going to get back to those core kind of more traditional types of programs? There's not an answer to that yet. The other question is, what is the baseline? And we talked about how really, if you take out that direct appropriation, what you're really looking at is about a 50% increase in the program size. Is that the baseline? Is that basically what you're working off of? Or is the full 1.2 trillion over 5 years, is that now the baseline that you're trying to build off of? And so not only what types of infrastructure are we going to try to cover in this bill, but also what funding levels are we actually going to look at as a starting point? Those are kind of the two key questions right now. And to be honest, which parties are in power is going to have a huge impact on the answers to those questions.
Well, I was going to ask you that. I know we are in an election year and we were discussing it. Is this going to be, when we get closer to the election and there's debates and it's all we can do to escape hearing about it for even a minute, is this going to be a hot topic amongst the parties that are running for various offices, you think?
Yeah, I think it will. You know, there's so many big projects. I mean, you know, the president has been very clear about his views on the success of this legislation. I mean, he had his fingerprints all over it. It wasn't as large as he had wanted, but he has certainly used it to maximum advantage. And I think he is going to be talking about the benefits that it has had across kind of every corner of this country. One of the interesting elements of this is that he originally wanted to focus, like his original proposal was not just limited to kind of brick and mortar, concrete and steel, but it was also focused on what he called quote unquote human capital, human infrastructure. And even though EJA doesn't go as far as he had proposed in some of those issues, there is a big emphasis on workforce training. There's a big emphasis on making sure that you're developing a workforce to be able to reduce that kind of construction cost impact that I talked about earlier. And that I think is going to be a key issue of the campaign as well. Not just how much money are we spending on infrastructure, look at all this great stuff that's getting built, but also what are we doing to actually train the people that are essential to delivering this infrastructure? How are we improving people's lives in a very direct and immediate way through this infrastructure bill?
I'm interested to see how that all shakes out. And of course, we like the funding in our industry.
Yes, we like.
Keep it coming.
Yeah. And the only thing that really concerns me, Sean, is in America, especially in this day and age, we can politicize anything, literally anything. And even to the point where in my endless hours of scrolling on TikTok, you see stuff about build back better. It's not really better. You know, just taking a phrase, right, that's perfectly harmless, and there, you simply can't debate that America's infrastructure needed an overhaul, at a minimum needed an overhaul.
That should be a bipartisan, slam dunk, right?
Right. So I'm afraid that this is going to become politicized because somebody can draw the line in the sand, and that's part of my concern. The other part of my concern is, even though we've been trying our hardest, we can't really pay for everything. We can't be the biggest military power in the world. We can't have forgiven all these COVID loans. We can't forgive all these student loans. We can't subsidize all these other things and constantly have a $1.2 trillion spending package every 5 years for infrastructure. So I don't know what gives, but your office is in D.C. I'm sure you've got it figured out, right?
Well, I don't think they pay us enough to have it all the way figured out, but I'll give you part of an answer. So before EJA was enacted earlier in 2021, the American Society of Civil Engineers actually released the latest draft of what they call their infrastructure report card. And it basically surveys infrastructure classes across the country, all different types of infrastructure, and talks about basically the backlog to bring that infrastructure up into a good condition. And they found, and again, this is before EJA was enacted, but right around the same time, they found that the U.S. needed to spend $6 trillion to bring our infrastructure up to a good condition. And I know you've had people who have taken a more sort of economist perspective on this on the show in the past. Obviously, the more you spend, we've talked about workforce constraints, supply chain constraints. I mean, there's not an endless supply of workers and materials to just build this stuff. So prices are going to go up. Obviously, there's that consideration. But my concern is that we have this landmark bill and people think that this is the solution to every problem and we don't need to continue to fund our infrastructure. We don't need to continue to focus on our infrastructure needs. And obviously this not only has a spending impact, it also has an impact on our international competitiveness. There are myriad examples of businesses that are falling behind competitively to overseas competitors because of the infrastructure challenges that we have in this country. The soybean growers, the agricultural industry, exporters. I mean, there are so many different examples of how American companies are losing market share because they do not have reliable infrastructure to get their goods to market.
That's the age-old problem. We see it in Virginia, where we have one of the biggest ports on the East Coast, but your port is only as good as you can offload the materials that come into it, as quickly as you can offload those materials.
Well, Sean, this has been completely eye-opening and educational, and you have answered so many questions that I have literally woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning pondering and didn't know where to look or who to ask. So I hope that our listeners enjoyed this as much as we did. Thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure to meet you and to have you on the show.
Oh, it was such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
All right. You got it here first, folks.